Hi, and welcome back to the Murder Show. We have missed you.
This is part two of Dean Coral. Lily's going to tell a story.
Yeah, it should be intense. So sorry about that. Just like trigger warning, there is a lot of boys molested and tortured. I'm not going into detail of what happened to each boy. Like, I will give an overview of common things Dean Coral did, but I just don't think it's appropriate for me to do that for 28 victims. And I don't think that's what they should be remembered by.
Right. That's not really the point of this podcast, to just go into detail about
how people literal were tortured. Torture. No, and he was like one of the worst torturers, like I think of serial killers.
Right.
Anyways.
Oh, should we get into it? I'm nervous.
I'm scarred. Like, I had to stop researching and I was like, I can research the rest later because this is like all so fucked up.
Yeah.
But yeah. Anyways, so last we talked about in part one, just to catch up, Coral lives in the Heights neighborhood. He started grooming this boy named Brooks when he was in sixth grade, and Brooks became his accomplice in getting boys to Coral's house for Coral to torture and murder. The last two we talked about were two brothers, the Waldrop brothers, and they had a father that nonstop looked for them. The police didn't do anything. The police thought the dad was crazy because the kids were runaways, but they were victims of Coral.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I remember the police incompetence.
Yeah, it gets a lot worse, so...
Great.
The next victim is Randall Harvey. Randall Harvey was 15 years old and was last seen by his family on March 9th, 1970, when he was bicycling towards Oak Forest, where he worked part-time as a gas station attendant. Harvey was driven to Coral's Magnum Road apartment, where he was raped, tortured, and subsequently killed by a single gunshot to the head. It was Brooks who picked up the boy and lured him to Coral's apartment.
Wow. Yeah.
Randall Harvey was found with 17 other victims at the boat stall that Coral rented, where he buried a majority of the victims. And he went unidentified for nearly 40 years. It's really sad. So this really badass lady who's a forensic anthropologist, her name is Sharon Derrick. She has made it her mission to identify the four unidentified boys of murder victims. So... Derek had no idea that there were still unidentified bodies until she came across them at the Harris County Institute of Forensic Science, where she worked in 2006. Harris County is where Houston is.
Wow.
So she worked as a forensic anthropologist there, and she was just going through the refrigerators, and it said unidentified mass murders. Because they're still known as the mass murders in Houston, and that's what was
Wait, so she didn't know it was Dean Coral.
But you know in Texas or in Houston especially, mass murders refers to the Dean Coral victims. So,
okay, got it.
They were just labeled like M68-833 or something like that, mass murders.
Wow.
And she was like,
wow,
we still have four boys here that are unidentified in our morgue that aren't buried with their families. Their families don't know. So she... was like, what the fuck? And she worked for 2 years looking for Randall Harvey in particular. So first, she sent the skull to the lab in Louisiana to create a computerized facial approximation. And then she went to visit Brooks in prison. Spoiler alert, Brooks is in prison for the rest of his life. So Brooks has been very hush since he was arrested. He told the police everything, where all the bodies were and what happened.
Yeah.
And he identified as many people as possible, but
right.
He never...
So why would he stop?
He never spoke to media. He never sensationalized himself. Wow. It's not like he tried to get a book deal like some of these creepers do.
Yeah.
He only spoke to close friends and would never talk to reporters or anyone else. He's tried to live a very quiet life in prison.
Right. I mean, do you think that could be the fact that, I mean, he's also a victim himself and he was manipulated into doing things? And
I'll go into that later, how I think he is extremely. Okay. I don't think the other accomplice that comes in later is as much as one, but this guy, I think he really is a victim. So Sharon Derrick knew she had to try to get him to talk and see if she knew with this like computerized image of the face, if he knew who the boy was. So He agreed to talk to her, and she showed Brooks the photo, and he said he didn't know his name, but he knew how he died and where he lived.
So he remembered that. Mm-hmm. He remembers all of these details of where he lived.
Well, because it's all in his neighborhood that he grew up in. There were boys that he took from his block to Coral. So he knew the neighborhood. Sure. He knew the house. He could, like, mark down the street. And also, he's been in prison since he was, like, 17.
But that's also another thing is, like, sometimes I kind of think that if you go through something traumatizing like that and you end up going to prison, you might want to just, like, block this out of your life and block these details in order to cope, especially if you do think that he was a victim and maybe he's reflecting and thinking, whoa, I did become a victim myself, and he's blocking that out. So I'm really surprised.
No, he didn't block anything out. And he was the person that identified, like, almost everyone and got these families to know that their sons were killed by Coral.
Wow.
She showed him the photo. He knew where he lived and how he died, but he didn't know his name. But through this information and through the address and these things, she was searching for like a year and a half for anyone related to him. And she found a cousin or something like that. And they put her, the forensic anthropologist, in touch with Randall Harvey's sisters, the boy who had died. So they had been searching for their brother for over 35 years.
No.
Unfortunately, so Randall Harvey's mother, Frances, passed away before and never found out what happened to her son. In May of 2008, the sisters shared their DNA, and in October 2008, it was a genealogical match for Randall Harvey.
So they still had usable, testable DNA for him?
Yeah, because they had his whole body still. They had his whole body in the refrigerator at the morgue.
Okay, this is so ignorant of me, but in my mind, he's a skeleton.
Yeah, but I think you can get mitochondrial DNA or something like that.
Okay, because even if you're in a fridge for 30 plus years, would your flesh still stay?
But I think your bones have DNA in them.
Do they?
Yeah, I think so. I think everything like in our body has DNA.
Okay.
And you can get mitochondrial DNA is like older. It's like older in the grand scheme of like evolution. Right. And that it's like always passed down from our mothers. So I think – and that's like – I think in a lot older skeletons, they get more mitochondrial DNA.
Okay.
I actually just read about that the other day. I think I'm right, but anyone that knows better, let us know.
I mean, obviously, you're probably right because they were able to get DNA. Yeah. So I'm you know,
so they and a lot of them still had like hair and stuff when they were found. So
So they still had those collections as well. Okay.
So Sharon Derrick is a really amazing woman that has worked really hard to identify these last four victims, known victims and bodies that they had. And I'll talk to her. I'll talk about her more as I go through the list. But the next two victims were David Hilligeist and Gregory Malley Winkley. David Hilligeist was only 13 years old and Gregory Winkley was 16. Mm. Mm. They were on their way to a neighborhood swimming pool on May 29th, 1971. They were last seen entering a white van together. Winkley was a former employee of the Coral Candy Company and was familiar with both Coral and Brooks. Winkley was also the boyfriend of Randall Harvey's sister, who was the last guy I just talked about that died.
Oh my goodness. It's the people closest to them.
They do this over and over again. They take brothers, they take families, they take boyfriends of sisters. Like, I don't understand how this – I mean, the community had to have known that.
Right.
But the police didn't do anything.
If it's the victims that have these close connections, you would think that if you do victimology
and you work backwards, you would find
people that interact.
It's obviously someone in your community.
Right.
It's, like, so infuriating, but –
but also on the other side, it's even just like grosser that they're victimizing people that they know super well and that they see all the time.
It's disgusting. They do it all of the time.
Like they know all these people. There's not one random.
Well, there's randoms to Coral that the two accomplices weren't involved with that he picked up on the street. But the two accomplices just basically knew everyone that they picked up to give
everyone
to Coral.
Like.
But that circles back in the end. And it's why Winkley and Hilligeist were strangled to death. And Donald and Jerry Waldrop's clothes, the two brothers that had passed that were killed before, were found in the bag with David Hilligeist and Gregory Winkley's skeletal remains. So they were misidentified as the brothers for a while.
Oh, okay.
There's a lot of misidentification in this case because, I mean, they found so many bodies at one time and before DNA and stuff. Mm-hmm. So David Hilligeist, though, had a badass mother and family who never, ever, ever listened to the police when they labeled David as a runaway.
Good.
His sisters would ride around the neighborhood with their boyfriend searching for him every night. The whole family would post flyers all over Houston that offered rewards, and his father took out a loan to hire a private investigator to find David. His mother, Dorothy Hilligeist, literally never stopped looking for him. They drove all around the country whenever they heard of a sighting. They reached out to psychics, newspapers, the National Enquirer, literally anything to get his name out there. Dorothy
doing the work that the police won't do.
Exactly. And she would call the Houston police whenever she got a slight tidbit of information, and she became like a, you know how neighborhoods, especially in the, or like when we were kids, it was like crime watchers. Like it was that guy with like the, the black guy with the coat and the with hat on. Yeah. And so you would have like a neighborhood watch. She was basically doing neighborhood watch because she would sit outside on her porch and look for anyone mysterious. She reported Coral's car to the Houston police.
Because she...
She
knew that it would be someone in the key.
Yes.
She had a feeling that they would be coming around the same type of areas. And she was right.
Yes. And she reported Coral's car and his license plate to the police.
Oh, my God. They did nothing.
Houston police never followed up, even though she literally gave him the license plate.
Of course.
I mean, it's so infuriating. One of the people that put up posters for David Hilligeist was a guy named Elmer Wayne Henley. Elmer Wayne Henley was a lifelong friend of Hilligeist, and he ends up becoming Coral's accomplice in a few months after this happened. So that's just like a weird thing that he was super close with his family and then ends up helping take more boys too.
I'm curious, and I'm sure you'll explain this in a bit, like how one boy would turn into an accomplice rather than a victim.
Oh, this happens because Henley was supposed to be a victim.
Okay. So you'll tell.
So,
ooh, okay. I'm interested.
After the boys' bodies were found, Dorothy, the mother, was interviewed, and she was asked about the accomplices' families that live in the neighborhood because they all live in a few block radius of each other. So she said, "I've known them all for years. I have a lot of compassion for them. Even with our grief, I can feel compassion for them because I feel like they are in a much tougher place than we are." Like these big accomplices' mothers, because they're just boys too that are, you know, it's like, I think it's such a nice thing for her to say about that. But you can see it. It's in a documentary called The Killing of America, and her interview's on there.
Okay.
So the next victim is Reuben Watson Haney. He was 17 and a friend of Brooks when he went missing on August 17th, 1971. He was walking home from a movie theater in Houston when Brooks and Coral saw him and stopped their car. Brooks convinced Reuben to get in the car and come party with him at Coral's new apartment. He died from asphyxiation due to strangulation and gagging. He was found in a garbage bag with his clothing, boots, and a sash cord tied around his neck. There was a gag and tape covering his face. Before Haney died, he called his mom and said he was with Brooks. The mom reported this to the police, and they did nothing.
No. Well, why am I acting like I'm surprised? But
if
are you
the
joking?
Police would have connected the dots at all, they have Coral's license plate. They have Brooks knowing all of the victims almost. They have Brooks, one of the mothers, telling them their son was with Brooks.
Literally. I like just go to Brooks, and I think that, well, obviously I'm making assumptions.
He would have broke.
But
Brooks would have broke.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I think as well. If the police went up to him, he would have just said everything.
He would have broke.
Coral up. Right. It would have taken like a 5-minute visit to Brooks.
So that was August 17th. And then in September, there's two unidentified victims. They didn't find the bodies for these victims. Brooks, in his confession, said that two boys were murdered during this time. The first boy was abducted from the Heights, and he was kept alive for multiple days before his murder. And this isn't corroborated because they haven't found the bodies, but Brooks has, from what I can tell, never lied.
Right.
So,
I mean, all of the other things have been correct.
So I just think that there's more bodies that they didn't look for. And actually, Brooks was telling the police, there's more bodies, don't stop searching. And they just stopped. So I totally believe that these victims are there. So Reuben Haney was murdered August 17th. And then the two unidentified victims that Brooks confessed to were around September. There were no confirmed victims until February of 1972. That's a 6-month break for this insane murderer that is on a spree. So I just don't think right. that he actually went on a break. I just don't think he used Brooks to get the boys to his apartment.
So Brooks doesn't necessarily know.
Yeah, because like no one ever interviewed Coral. So there's no way to know what mm-hmm. victims right. he took on his own.
Mm-hmm.
By September 1971, Coral had killed at least 11, if not 13, including those two unidentified victims. Mm-hmm. And it's so odd to me that literally no one noticed anything was wrong except the boys' families. And the cops aren't doing shit. They're still labeling all these boys as runaways. When there are 13 boys all around the same age, most of whom,
like, give me a break.
Coral knew, or Brooks knew, or both of them knew.
Right.
It's like mind-boggling to me. We have Dorothy Hilligeist telling the police that Coral's suspicious and giving his license plate. We have Haney's mother saying he was with Brooks. I just don't understand what the police are doing. And get this, his coworkers at this time never had a bad word to say about him. And his landlord said he was a great tenant.
Well, that kind of makes sense, no?
I mean, it has to be. That's the way I'm like, he had to have been so sneaky, I guess.
He had to have been like perfect to not have any suspicion. Yeah.
And
which makes sense because wasn't he like a really nice guy? Like if I remember from the last episode, he was really well received by everyone and girls liked him. And
yeah, he was just like normal and no one thought that right. he – I haven't mentioned this yet, but he had a girlfriend this mm-hmm. whole time.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Her name is Betty Hawkins. She was a single mother.
She was never over at the house.
Well, no one could go to Coral's house without telling him or he would get really mad. He would like get
yeah,
really
I wonder why.
Yeah, exactly. So she was a single mother and she met Coral when she worked at the candy factory. They started dating in 1968 and the first confirmed victim was murdered in 1970. It's pretty mind-boggling to me that I think I would notice that about my boyfriend, but you know, I don't know.
I don't know. She's a single mom. She might be busy.
Yeah.
She might not see it as a super serious relationship, and so she doesn't really care.
No, she thought that he was, like, normal and wanted to get married, and they had, like, a sexual relationship, and he said that she was, like, he was never, like, violent during sex. So it's, like, I guess he was really tricking everyone.
Isn't that, like, the scariest? Like, that's even scarier than the killers where you look back and you're like, oh, it was so obvious.
No, this is scary. You know? He has to be one of the –
this is way scarier.
I'm, like, scarred from reading all this stuff. Like, it's so bad. So
– it makes me, like, think that I can't trust anyone.
I would not ever be able to trust anyone again if I knew this man and I found out all this stuff. So
– right.
During this cool-down period of 6 months, Elmer Wayne Henley comes into the picture for Coral.
Mm-hmm.
This was in the wintertime of 1971. Brooks introduced Henley to Coral with the intention of Henley becoming Coral's next victim.
Mm-hmm.
Part one, I talked about how Brooks, the first accomplice, was more reserved, had been bullied, more like geeky, I guess. While Henley was the exact opposite. Henley liked to smoke weed. He liked to drink. And he had like a juvenile assault charge. He was seen as like a bad popular boy in the Heights neighborhood. And he also was always at, like, the popular teenage spots. He knew mm-hmm. everyone. And Ooh. So he did have an extremely abusive alcoholic father. So mm-hmm. cue Coral stepping in
sure.
and being that father figure for him. But
the male role model as well.
Yeah, exactly. So
yeah, father figure.
Henley's parents got divorced in 1970, and Henley dropped out of middle school to help his mother financially. He got involved with Coral in 1971. He was 15.
Gosh.
Yeah, so basically what happened, Brooks brought Henley to the apartment to Coral's, and for some reason Henley felt like it was super important to get Coral to like him, and they just started talking, and they, like, I guess vibed really well, and Coral decided not to kill him.
How interesting.
Yeah, and so he started their relationship off by telling Henley if he ever needed cash or help with anything that Henley could come to Coral. And after a few weeks, Coral told the same story to Henley that he had told to Brooks, that he was part of an underground child pornography ring and he would pay him $200 for each boy Henley delivered to Coral.
Mm-hmm.
Now, hearing this, most people would be like, I'm good. I'm not going to sell any boys into child pornography.
Right. But he has a struggling family.
Exactly. And you know what? He said no at first.
Okay. But okay.
Things were super hard at home and his family needed money.
Yeah.
And he was also a bad boy. He kind of thought it was cool and like intriguing to be a part of an underground crime ring.
Okay. Yeah. Like, it's really hard to judge someone when they're in such a desperate situation, unless you've been in like really such a dire, desperate situation. You have no idea.
And Coral didn't say, I'm going to kill these boys. I mean, I'm sure that is part of the justification for his actions, you know?
Yeah. Wait, so did Brooks know that Coral was killing them?
Not at first. He said the same thing to him, that they were part of like an underground pornography ring. Mm-hmm. But after like 1 week, Coral tells both of them the truth. Like, so they know right away.
Okay. Okay.
In February of 19.
But he has to get them in first. And so he's just telling them little by little. Okay.
Yeah. But then he gets them to bring one accomplice. And then after he gets the accomplices to bring in one victim. And then after that one victim, he tells them he died. And then they feel, I think, trapped. Like, oh, I already did this. I could be in trouble. Like,
I see. Yeah, totally. Because they already know that they're kind of responsible.
Yeah.
Right? And yeah.
It's like all a complete manipulation trap thing for Coral to do to these kids.
Mm-hmm.
In February of 1972, Henley brought his first victim to Coral. His name was Willard Rusty Branch Jr. He was 17 years old and was walking around his neighborhood when Coral and Henley spotted him. They pulled over. Henley asked if Rusty wanted to smoke some pot. And the next thing you know, Rusty is in the car. And then he's at Coral's apartment. Henley says he left and got $200 from Coral the next day. He says he had no idea what happened. He left the apartment. He was fine. He wasn't like wrapped up in the torture board or anything. Rusty was sodomized, castrated, and then shot in the head. He was buried at the boathouse.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really fucked up. Rusty's father was a Houston police officer. And he searched really hard for his son.
Fuck, is this like finally the time that they pay attention or no? Jesus.
Okay. His father died of a heart attack in his search for Rusty. This one is really sad. And Rusty wasn't identified for 13 years. He was identified in 1985 after his sister contacted the medical examiner's office because she thought one of the unidentified victims of Coral was her brother. She was right.
Okay.
Henley said that he left, he got $200 and didn't know what happened. And he said 2 days later, he found out Coral had killed the boy. He didn't go to the cops or tell anyone. Coral even told Henley that he had killed his childhood friend, Hilly Geist, that Henley had been looking for earlier. And it didn't faze him.
Oh my goodness.
And Henley had been at that boy's mom's house telling her, it's going to be okay. There's probably an explanation for this. Like, literally consoling the mother. And then he finds out that what happened to his childhood friend, like best friend neighbor he grew up with his whole life, and just brings Coral another boy.
Okay, but you know what I think?
What?
I think that in this moment, Henley knows that he was supposed to be a victim instead of an accomplice.
He's scared. He's scared.
He reflects and he was like, fuck. That was going to be me. He's scared as fuck. He can't pull away now because he's just going to turn into a victim. Like,
yeah, and I'll get into more of why he stays because it's pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. He talks about it because he's a loudmouth in prison. He'll fucking talk to anybody.
Oh, yeah. So,
And him and Brooks don't speak.
Oh. Were they working together at all during?
It's going to start.
Okay.
That was on February 9th that Rusty Branch Jr. was kidnapped and murdered. So Frank Aguirre was 18 years old and a friend to Henley and Brooks when he went missing. Apparently, Long John Silver's was like the cool place to hang out back in the day. And it was one of Henley's like hot spots that he was always at. And Aguirre worked there. Frank Aguirre, the victim, worked there. Sorry. I feel like I'm saying so many names and it's confusing.
I think it's Aguirre.
Aguirre. Thank you.
Is it a Spanish last name?
A-G-U-I-R-R-E.
One kid I know in high school had that last name and it was Aguirre, but that doesn't mean anything. Okay. It could be
Frank Aguirre. I don't know. Okay.
Maybe a listener can tell us.
His name Frank.
Sure.
Okay. Frank worked at Long John Silver's and after he closed one night, Henley lured him to Coral's apartment where Brooks and Coral were waiting. This was the first time Coral and his two accomplices all worked together. So all three of them were together. And this is where, like, the pretty infamous handcuff game started for these three. So they would play this game called the handcuff game. And either Henley or Brooks would put on the handcuffs and tell one of the victims, oh, they're trick handcuffs, try to get out of them.
God, I hate this detail.
And Henley and Brooks would have a key in their back pocket.
No, I don't like it.
To get out. And then they'd put the handcuffs on the boy. And then the boy would be handcuffed and wouldn't be able to get out of it. Because I could totally see your teenage boy like, I could fucking do it. You know, like you're just like, oh, I can do it.
Yeah.
Like you just are.
Yeah.
It's like just normal. It's.
Wait, I'm confused. Like do what?
No, like. Get out of the handcuffs? Yeah. Because like if they're all passing the handcuffs around, like, look, can you try to get out of the trick handcuffs? Like, look.
Oh, okay. But they were actually unscrewing it with the key.
Yeah. They would have it behind their backs and have a key in their back pocket.
Okay.
Undo it and then be like, look, I got out of them. Can you get out of them?
Right. Oh my gosh. I remember when I was younger, me and my friends had like magic kits and things like that and would have fake handcuffs, the Chinese finger traps and stuff like that. And we would all play with them.
Yeah, exactly. You know? It's totally normal.
If I was them, I would be like, oh yeah, this is like,
I want to try. I want to try. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Henley first did the trick, got him out with his back pocket, got the key out, unlocked himself. Then Brooks did it. Same thing. Got out.
Okay.
And then Frank put them on. And he couldn't get out because he didn't have a key. They weren't trick handcuffs. They're real handcuffs.
Mm-hmm.
After he couldn't get out, Coral dragged Frank to his bedroom while Henley and Brooks waited in the living room. Henley's story is that he had no idea that Coral would assault and kill Frank and that he begged him not to. I don't think that's true. Henley says this a lot, but I think you know what's going on at this point.
Yeah.
I think that he knows. I think he knew, and I think that's, like, maybe a coping mechanism.
It definitely could be. Yeah, I don't know. That's hard to say. And also, if it was true, maybe deep down he knew that it wouldn't even do anything.
Yeah. So
even if he was begging.
Frank was raped, tortured, and strangled to death, and he was buried at High Island Beach. The main two burial spots are the boat shed that Coral rented and High Island Beach. Mm-hmm. A few more come in later.
Okay. Wait, is this a beach next to the ocean? Isn't Houston inland?
No, Houston's a port. It's on the Gulf. Oh. That's why Houston's such a big city. It's a port city.
Oh my gosh. How did I not know this? I need to review my geography.
No, it's okay. Because Houston is so big. So like you don't see the ocean.
I think I'm thinking of Dallas.
Yeah, Dallas is inland. But Houston, like Houston proper is like not on the water. Like you could just go down a little bit and it's on the water. Like the downtown, you don't like see the ocean from.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. Cool. So that was on, what did I say? That was on March 24th.
Wait, of course it's by the water. The hurricanes?
Yeah.
I'm so stupid.
Okay. No, but you can get hit by hurricanes a little bit more inland too. But okay, so.
True. Okay, thanks.
Less than a month later, Mark Scott went missing. Mark Scott was 17 years old and he was a friend to both Henley and Brooks.
Wait, so did Henley? Wait, yeah, obviously. Okay, just kidding. Keep going.
Mark was taken back to Coral's house and he fucking fought back when they tried to tie him up.
Wow.
And he grabbed a knife and started swinging it at Coral. And it ripped his shirt and it barely broke skin.
Oh, no.
Henley ran to get the pistol and pointed it at Mark Scott's head. So Mark just dropped the knife. And according to Brooks, Mark just gave up. He knew it was over. His friends literally lured him there. And Henley was one of like his childhood friends that was pointing a gun at his head.
Oh, my God. And this is 3-1 right now.
Oh. He was raped, tortured, strangled, and buried at High Island Beach. His remains have never been found.
No.
Yeah. And this was one of the bodies that Brooks was saying, I know his body is there. You need to keep digging.
Yeah.
And the police just stopped.
God. Oh, God.
Okay. So the next victims, it was a month later, Johnny DeLone and Billy Bausch. Johnny DeLone was 16 and Billy, B-A-U-L-C-H, Bausch.
Yeah, that sounds
right. Billy Bausch was 17 when they were abducted by Coral and his two accomplices, Brooks and Henley. Bausch was a former employee of the Coral Candy Company and was familiar with both Brooks and Henley. The two had left Johnny DeLeon's house to buy sodas from the local corner store when they got picked up by the trio. So according to Brooks, Henley started getting really fucked and like super involved in the murders at this time.
Really?
Henley, Brooks, I don't think ever was, I think he helped tie up the boys, but I don't think Brooks found satisfaction in like torturing them or murdering them. I think that he was more of like a viewer, I guess.
Sure.
This is when Henley gets.
Wait, I have a question. So during the actual torture, rape, and murder? Were both of the boys there?
Normally, no. So, like, especially... Right. So, they would help tie up the boys, and then Henley and Brooks would either be in the living room, and the boy would
like,
be...
Like, leave,
the,
right?
Yeah, they would either leave or be in the living room, and Coral would take the boy to, like, the back room.
Okay.
And but they would help bury the bodies.
Oh, shit. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
That's how they knew where all the bodies were.
Oh, but this wasn't every single victim, right? This was some because they didn't know the whole time.
Yeah, because that they were dying. Like they would when they helped someone, they like knew that they died and they buried them. But if they didn't help Coral and Coral did it on his own, like they didn't know anything about it.
Right. Okay. I understand.
Yeah.
And but this is where it changes, right?
So this is when Henley starts getting like really violent. And Brooks like Henley is like waving guns around and stuff. So
is Coral inviting him to be involved or does he volunteer to be involved? Like who's taking the initiative to get him more involved?
Henley has never been like, I did this. Like I got super involved. Like this is from Brooks' point of view. So Brooks isn't like,
oh, okay.
And it's like their relationship dynamic is really interesting too, because like Brooks was the original that needed more like affection and attention. But Henley is more like sadistic in a way and like enjoying it. So you'll see what happens. It's actually really sad what happens to Brooks, but
okay.
This part's really fucked up, so please bear with me or just fast forward. But the two boys, Johnny DeLone and Billy Balsh, were tied to Coral's bed, and after the rape and torture, Henley strangled Billy Balsh to death. He then shouted, "Hey, Johnny," and shot Johnny DeLone in the forehead. The bullet exited through his ear, and he was still alive. Johnny DeLeon begged Henley to stop, and then Henley strangled him to death. Yeah.
So Coral's not doing any of this.
Oh, Coral raped and tortured them, but Henley killed them.
Oh my god.
Yeah. So that's where I'm saying that no matter what, that was the line that he chose to cross. Like, I don't think Coral told him to scream, "Hey, Johnny," at a little boy and shoot him in the head.
Right. I'm just curious, like, obviously it's impossible to know because it's in his own mind, but I wonder if it was, like, a gradual desensitization interest, or if it was, like, yeah, okay.
I think it was definitely.
Like, one day just.
I think it was a gradual like, exactly what you were saying. Like, I think that it got to seem normal, and I think that he probably felt like he was abused by his father, so it's, like, normalized in another way as your childhood, but. This is really sad, too.
Oh, that's just so sad.
14 months later, they would also kill Billy Balsh's little brother. They destroyed these families. So both of these boys were buried at High Island Beach. The next victim was Billy Ridinger. He was taken in the summer of 1972. And I want to start this off with Billy got away.
This boy got away. Okay.
He was just, so he got lured to Coral's by the boys and got tied up to the torture board. And for some reason.
And he got away?
For some reason, Coral just let him go.
No.
Yes. The boys didn't beg him or anything. Coral was just like, go.
What?
And he never told anyone.
Oh my God. Because he's scared of the retribution or something. Oh my God.
He just got away.
So he. What?
I know.
Wow. He is so lucky.
Yeah. Shit. Like, count your blessings, that guy. So
did he end up, like, saying this happened to him?
Yeah, later? And Henley and Brooks both said this happened.
Okay. So everyone is corroborating each other's stories and everything. Oh, my God. That is, like, so traumatizing.
And all these are friends. Like, these are Henley and Brooks' friends.
Right.
So I'm going to pause on the victims for a second, and I want to talk about the relationship between Coral, Henley, and Brooks. So Henley obviously started enjoying this shit. Like, that's pretty obvious. And he was quickly becoming Coral's favorite because he was enjoying it. Henley was becoming Coral's favorite. So
he saw him as a protege, maybe.
Yeah, and all this time, Coral would always proposition Brooks to have anal sex with him, and Brooks always denied it. Because remember, Brooks was assaulted by
his father.
No, Brooks was assaulted by Coral. Like, they would participate in oral sex together and things like that, but it was like a grooming situation. So But he always, Coral always wanted to have penetrative sex with Brooks, but Brooks always said no.
Okay.
After some time, the fact that Brooks said no had really aggravated Coral. So, in sometime in the early summer days of 1972, this is so fucked up. And I know that Brooks did bad things, but this is so fucked up that this happened to him. So, Coral asked Henley to knock Brooks out when he came into the house that day. Henley hit Brooks over the head and Brooks was unconscious. Brooks woke up on Coral's torture board and he was bleeding from his anus.
Oh my God.
He assaulted him repeatedly. He then released Brooks. He didn't kill him. And Brooks continued to help Coral.
He's so broken.
Yeah. I think that his reasoning for all of this is so different than Henley's. Like, I find them as completely different. Like, I have a lot more compassion for Brooks after reading all of this.
Right. God.
I feel so sad for him, even though I know, like, this might be controversial, but he spent his whole life in prison since he was, like, 17 now. And I kind of think that he actually could have been, like, what's it called you're supposed to do in prison? Fix them?
God, what is the word? It starts with an R.
Yeah, it starts with an R. Rehabilitate. Okay, yeah.
Rehabilitate.
I really do think Brooks could have been rehabilitated because
I think so too, to be honest. I mean, the thing is, if you think about it, you have free will. Yes, he was an accomplice. He has free will, but do you really have free will with a gun pointing at your head? That's
the
question.
Do you have free will off of a man who's been grooming you since you're in sixth grade, molesting you?
Right.
I just...
Like, I... Is it too, like, early to ask you, like, so I know that he got life in prison, but what was the charge?
It's too early. I still haven't even done all the research on that part. I had to stop after I did all these victims. Okay. Last night I was like...
Yeah.
I might die. Like, I can't read about this for a day.
No, definitely. Well, because my thought is, considering all the evidence and details, he is not guilty of first-degree murder. He's not.
But I think that means so, there's 28 victims. So, I think...
I'm sorry, but it's not...
I don't think so either. I think Henley is. Henley shot that boy in the head and strangled the other boy.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was premeditated. He lured them there. But the thing is, Brooks is guilty of being an accomplice. What is it? Whatever. Aiding and abetting. Desecration of corpse. These things.
Yeah, and like helping to cover up a crime. Because I think he buried them all.
Yeah. But I really don't think he had free will. I don't think that his the premeditation comes from him. Well, it doesn't. The premeditation comes from him.
I don't think so
either.
Him.
Well, okay. I guess we'll find out next episode what the charges were and we can talk more.
Yeah, because I'll talk about like what they got charged for, how this all got found out, and what happened to Coral, and then like more potential victims. And they're looking for more victims now too, so I'll talk about that. But
okay. Oof, the thoughts are already starting.
Yeah, this case has a lot of thoughts. Like, I'm sorry if my research is a little scatterbrained just because there's so much information. I'm, like, trying to get it all down, but...
The research is amazing.
Thank you. I'm, like, looking at autopsy reports. I'm really going in, dude. I'm, like...
Nice.
There was... So, that was... Sorry, I got mixed up. So, that was Frank. Okay. The last two victims were Johnny DeLeon and Billy Balch in May 21st, 1972. And those are the two that Henley murdered himself. So,
okay.
In July, it was July 20th, 1972, when Stephen Sickman was 17. It was July 20th, 1972, when Stephen Sickman disappeared. He was 17 and he was last seen leaving a party in the Heights. He was beaten with a blunt force object and suffered several fractured ribs before he was strangled with a nylon cord and buried in the boat shed.
Oh.
Stephen Sickman's remains were identified in April of 2011, almost 39 years after his death.
Wait, I have a question. How big is this boat shed?
Exactly. I don't really understand. It's pretty big. Like, I'll show you pictures of the Houston PD, like, digging it up.
Okay.
But... He buried them on top of each other. So, like, he would dig the first grave
really
deep.
So, the first one would have had... Okay, I was just
going to ask then,
that. Okay, okay.
Like, they would be kind of buried on top of each other.
But How sinister is that? Because if you think about it, the forethought that it requires to dig that deep. That you're going to dig deep and bury your first victim deep, you know that you're having plenty more coming after
that. That's why these can't have been his only victims. Like, he had to start There's no way.
Yeah. He knew.
Yeah. Like, who knows what he was doing in Indiana when he was with his grandma? Like,
oh, God.
Stephen Sickman's remains were identified in April of 2011, almost 39 years after his death. His remains were misidentified as Mark Scott. Mark Scott was buried at the body that was never
the
found.
The beach. Yeah. Oh, okay.
And
yeah,
this
okay.
is where Brooks and Henley, they both insisted that Mark Scott's remains were buried at High Island Beach. And this could not be Mark Scott. It was. They said, that body's not Mark Scott. We know that. We don't know who it is, but it's not Mark Scott. The police didn't listen. They didn't care. Even though they were telling the truth the whole time.
Why would they lie about this one detail?
It took 39 years to identify this body.
My God.
Yeah, it's...
Did our forensic psychologist?
Our girl Sharon Derrick.
Forensic scientist? Okay, so she's the one that identified this body.
Yeah.
Okay.
She identifies all of them after, like, 2008.
Okay. So,
The next victim happened a month later. They hit the month mark. It's, like, July 20th, and then it's August 21st. You know, it's, like, the month mark is coming, so...
I wonder if that has to do anything with the stars and retrogrades or something. It probably isn't. And
Coral's probably
I don't have any excuse for this. We'll find out. We can find out. I'm not trying to make any like astrological excuses for this.
But it's just interesting to know, you know.
It's just interesting because most of the signs begin and end in the 20, 21st, 22nd.
And a lot of the murders happen the 20, 21st, especially in this year. The next victim was Roy Bunton, and he was 19 when he was abducted while walking to work at a shoe shop. He was the assistant manager. He was found with a Turkish towel gagged in his mouth with tape covering his face and mouth. He was shot twice in the head and buried in the boat shed.
Oh.
Roy's remains were also identified in 2011.
Okay.
In 2009, Roy's sister called Sharon Derrick, our girl, the forensic anthropologist that had been identifying these boys. And she asked if her brother Roy could be one of the unidentified bodies. Roy had really long legs, and none of the unidentified bodies matched his description. So Sharon Derrick said, no, I don't think so, and kind of put the whole conversation out of her head. Because she was working with these four bodies that she had, and she didn't realize how many of the other victims were misidentified, even in 2011.
Right, like within each other, right? Like putting
these victims that were identified in 1973 are buried next in a family plot that's not, they were buried in the wrong place. They were misidentified.
Right. Okay.
And so she didn't realize that yet when the sister called. Yes. So she's like, I have these four bodies. I don't think any of them are Roy.
Oh. So his body was actually buried because they thought it was some other boy.
Yeah.
Oh my.
So in 2009, the sister called. And then in 2010, the body that was believed to be Michael Balch was misidentified and was actually Roy Bunton.
Oh.
His body was in the Balch family cemetery, and that was never
so him. So did she have to go to the family and say, hey, I want to exhume his body?
Yeah, they had to exhume the body. But all of these families are so
cool. Like,
they're like, I want these other boys to rest in peace, and I want my boy with me, you know, like they're very
but it's so sad because they had the closure of burying him and then they've never found his real body.
Yeah, and
right?
his brother was murdered too, the misidentified body.
Right. So
neither Roy Bunton or Steve Sickman, the last boy I spoke about, were identified by Henley or Brooks as a victim. That's why they weren't identified.
Okay.
All the information the police ever got, they didn't do any of their own investigating. They literally were just like, who were the victims? And Brooks and Henley told them all the victims they knew. And if they didn't know their name, they said where they lived, how they died, where their bodies were. So the police didn't do any of their own investigating, even though Coral killed on his own. And these are two examples, because Henley and...
They didn't go like, oh, this was happening, so let me see if there's any other missing boys around.
When there were 40 plus missing boys in these years that they were active.
Oh,
it's so frustrating, and it's believed that Coral acted on his own for these two murders.
Okay.
And it makes you wonder, he was he acting alone when he took those long breaks, that 6 month break, that 4 month break? Like 100% he was.
Mm-hmm.
The next two victims are Wally J. Simino. It's a French last name. It's a Cajun okay. last name, right? I think he's from Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And Richard Humphrey. I'm going to call him Wally J though. And Wally mm-hmm. J was 14 and Richard Humphrey was 13. When they were walking, I couldn't get a clear picture, but they were either walking to Hamilton Junior High School or to Humphrey's home when they got picked up by Brooks and his Corvette on October 3rd, 1972. They were taken to Coral's apartment where they were tortured. That night, Wally J attempted to call his mother at Coral's residence. He screamed "Mama" into the phone and then it disconnected.
No.
He was 14 years old.
No.
Yeah. Henley accidentally shot Richard Humphrey in the mouth and it exited through his neck.
Excuse me? Accidentally in the mouth?
He was probably torturing him with a gun in his mouth and it went off.
Fuck.
But he said it was an accident.
Oh.
A few hours later, Wally J. and Richard Humphrey were strangled and buried in a joint grave at Coral's boat shed. Their bodies were found directly above Jimmy Glass and Danny Yeats.
Wow. And they were at least 2 years before, no?
They were 1 year before. They were a year before, or maybe a year and a half year. Before.
Wow.
So Jimmy Glass and Danny Yates were those victims that were at the like church concert thing with their dad and brother, and mm-hmm. they were sitting in the front, and then they just were never seen again when they walked out.
My God.
And they were like the same age, and they were buried right. underneath. And they both had joint graves. Yeah, it's like sadistic. But
was that done on purpose?
I think it was, but Brooks and Henley were just told where to bury them. Like Coral would be like bury them there. I think Coral knew where all the bodies were because I think he probably got off by knowing where they were.
Oh my God, he had like a mental map.
Yeah, and I mean
of everything.
We will never know, but because he's never spoken to, but.
Right.
A month later, Richard Kepner was 19 when he vanished on his way to call his fiance from a payphone. He was strangled and buried at High Island Beach. His remains were identified in September of 1983.
Okay.
So I couldn't get that much information on him. I really couldn't, mm-hmm. but that's all I know. So
mm-hmm.
I want to pause for a second and just reiterate we just talked about 10 more boys between the ages of 13 and 19 yeah. that disappeared in 10 months. And they're all from the same neighborhood.
Oh, my God.
I don't understand what the police were thinking. The same cops have to be taking these missing person reports, no?
100%. Have to.
And not to mention the countless other boys that went missing and the ones that are believed to be victims of Coral. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so frustrating to me. 10 boys have disappeared in the past 10 months. In the year before that, 13 boys that were all victims of Coral. So
my God.
Every month he's killing a boy.
Right.
Like,
I'm curious, like, were any families talking to one another and kind of... Like, I don't know.
I don't think that the families connected
together
to the dots as much because these were all like working class families that still had to like.
Sure.
And so I think they knew each other. And I think some women, like, I definitely think that some knew of each other. But if you were on one end of the Heights and another family mm-hmm. was on the other, you might not mm-hmm. know that family and you might not know that happened.
Sure.
And I don't think that there was like as much leisure time for these families because a lot of these kids
hang out and get to know each
other. Yeah, and like a lot of them were single moms or single dads and they had to work all the time and they were latchkey kids, you know.
Right. I also wonder if some families did internalize what the cops told them. I know some didn't, but if some actually believed that they were runaways.
No, a lot of them did believe that, though, because they would search all around for their kid in runaway shacks and all this stuff. And, like, a congressman from Houston tried to put – because when all this was happening, they realized there were so many runaways, and they tried to create this, like, federal law that would create runaway houses that were safe for runaway boys because so many were running away. But it's because Coral was murdering them. It's not because they were runaways. I think they noticed that there were a lot of boys running away, but they never thought – I think they just never thought a a teenage boy would be victimized, I guess. Like,
right.
I do think that if this was 20 little girls going missing in a year in a neighborhood,
it could have been different.
Would have been a lot different. But I think there's a lot of assumptions about males and masculinity, especially at that time. So I don't think that's where the police's heads were at.
Also, when, what, like, how old was the youngest victim?
13.
13.
The oldest is 19, so I think.
It could also, like, let's say the victims were a lot younger. Obviously, it would be less realistic. But a 13-year-old, your parents maybe could believe that you could survive on your own out there and that you actually ran away.
Or, and they also think if they all know each other, maybe they're, like, meeting up somewhere.
That's what I'm thinking, too. Like, the police are telling the families this. So even if they are connected with other families, they're like, oh, both of our boys, maybe they're together. And that's just – it makes it sadder.
It's so fucked up. And there's not Facebook. There's not Nextdoor. Like, I know about every crime because I have citizens. So, like, we can connect dots so easy now with our phones. But back then, if you didn't have a big community that all knew each other, it wasn't – and the police weren't doing shit to help you, like
– right. It's really hard for you to get all the information. They don't know that it's this many boys, probably.
I mean, they could have gone through the files and seen how many boys were missing, but it's not like it was on a computer, like, 84 missing boys. No one has connected any of these dots. There's 23-plus boys missing in a year and a half, and no one's saying anything. Coral's also still, like, totally under the radar. No one sees anything wrong with him, and he would actually come around Henley's house all the time. And he would help fix the cars or fix things around the house. And he was super nice to Henley's little brothers. He was a little bit too interested in Henley's little brother.
Okay. Ooh, I kind of see where this might go.
Henley's mom even invited Coral to join them on Easter because he was so kind to her family.
Wow.
So now we got to, so we finished 1972. That was a big year, like one kid a month, basically. Now we get to 1973. The first victim of 1973 was Joseph Lyles. He was 17 and he was picked up by Coral on February 1st. He lived on the same street as Brooks, and apparently Brooks saw Coral grab him, but Brooks wasn't involved. He just saw it.
Wow. Wow.
We don't know much about this because neither Brooks or Henley were involved, but he was buried at Jefferson County Beach. And Jefferson County Beach is a new burial spot. And they believe that there's more bodies there that are not found, too.
You would think so.
So there's more bodies at every single burial site, they think. So we have High Island Beach. We have Jefferson County Beach. And we have the boat shed right now. The boat shed has the most bodies. Here's another big break between killings. There are 4 months between Joseph Lyles' murder and the next murder spree that Coral goes on. There are a few reasons that this could be. Apparently, Coral was suffering from a hydrocele. I didn't know what that was, so I Googled it for us.
Never heard of that.
And it's an accumulation of fluids around the testicle.
Okay.
Yeah. Sounds like karma to me. Like a little form of it.
Does.
So I don't know how that impacts your sexual drive or whatever, but apparently he had one then, so he might have been doing less things.
There's probably pain involved.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he probably liked pain. It's like a sadistic motherfucker. So,
who knows?
Yeah. Another reason could be that at this time, Brooks and Henley are starting to be like, what the fuck? We got to get out of this, kind of. So,
really? Okay.
Henley tried to.
Henley was like this?
Yeah, he tried to join the Navy to get away, but he was denied because, remember, he dropped out of middle school. So he didn't have enough education to go into the Navy.
Also, is he 18 already?
No.
Okay, so double whammy.
Yeah, but I think I guess he was trying. Maybe he was 17. I know how old he is. I say it later, but during this whole time that I'm talking about, Coral has lived in like 5 or 6 different apartments. Like, he doesn't stay put very long, and I think that's on purpose so no one gets suspicious. Like, none of his neighbors get suspicious.
Okay, the cleanup? And the moving of the torture devices?
So he would put plastic sheeting down on the floor like Dexter.
Oh, my fucking God.
Yeah. I'm not sure how he explained the torture boards when he moved out. But so.
I guess because it's big. Like, if you've seen the picture, we posted a picture on Instagram of the torture board.
You can fit 2 bodies on it.
Fuck. And it's not like you can like put it in a suitcase or anything. Maybe he wrapped it in like garbage bags or something, or plastic.
Yeah.
So it just looked like he was moving like a table piece of plywood or something. Yeah. Yeah.
I haven't really bothered everyone with his history of moving, but he moved a lot.
It's like so unnecessary to speculate, but I'm just like, what the fuck?
But no. But this part is important that he moved, because his father, so he always stayed in contact with his father, even though his mother moved, and his father still lived in, and he lived in an area in called Pasadena that's like outside of Houston. Mm-hmm. His father had remarried and he moved to like a different place in Houston, but he still had the house. So he let Dean live in that house at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So Dean moves into this house, and I think it's because he finally is like not sharing walls with anyone and like has his own space. He amps the murders the fuck up. 8 boys are killed in 3 months.
Oh my God.
So after this big move into the house, the first murder was of Billy Ray Lawrence on June 4th, 1973. This one, all of them are really messed up, but this one really bothered me. So just soaring. Billy Ray Lawrence was 15. Billy Ray was a friend of Henley and had called his dad and asked if he could go fishing with his friends. He was picked up by Brooks and Henley and taken to Quarles' new house. He was forced to write a note to his father, and sensing he would be killed at the end, he wrote, "Daddy, I hope you know I love you. Your son, Billy." So sad.
Oh.
He was kept alive by Coral for 3 days on the plywood torture board because,
oh my God,
Coral really liked him, according to Brooks. He was killed and buried at Lake Sam Rayburn. That one it's so sad. He knew he was
gonna
die. He was 15, like writing a letter to his family. Mm-hmm. It's so sad. So that was on June 4th. On June 15th, just 11 days later, Ray Blackburn, a 20-year-old married man, was hitchhiking back to Louisiana to see his newborn baby. He was picked up and strangled at Coral's residence and buried at Lake Sam Rayburn. Okay. So this happens like less than a month later, but it's July. So in July of 1973, Henley was attending driving school where he met 15-year-old Homer Garcia. I know it may seem like it's been a long time, but Henley's only 16 or 17 at this point.
Wow.
Homer Garcia called his mother to say he was spending the night with a friend. He was shot in the head and chest and buried at Lake Sam Rayburn.
Do we know if Coral was involved or if it was just Henley?
Yeah. It was at Coral's house. But I mean, at this point, well, the ones that just involve Henley, mm-hmm. you don't know the truth.
Okay.
Because Brooks wasn't there.
Okay. So we don't know if Henley will tell the truth.
Exactly. So at this point, Brooks and his girlfriend, he had a girlfriend, wow. Brooks did. They had gotten pregnant.
Wow.
So they got married. And Brooks is like, yeah, no, bye. Like, I have a family and I don't want to be involved in this. So he's not involved. He wasn't involved in that murder and he's not involved in the next 3 murders.
Oh, I'm happy for
him. He's trying to. I know, me too. But don't worry. Something bad happens, I'll tell you in part 3. Brooks has had, I understand that he did bad things, but
I really think he was a victim.
His life, it's just like every bad stick was chosen. Like,
to me, he's a victim.
Me too. Also, Brooks and Henley can see that Coral is just like off his fucking rocker. He's super erratic. He never smokes cigarettes, but he's starting to fucking smoke cigarettes. So they always can tell when he's going to like ask them to get somebody because he's like fucking chain smoking in the house and like being crazy.
Ooh.
And Brooks described it as a bloodlust to kill.
Ugh.
Yeah. And like shit is just like hitting the fan. And Henley feels really trapped and like he can't leave because, as I said, Coral really liked Henley's little brothers. And Henley thought that if he left, Coral would take his little brothers and kill them.
Sure.
He thought that Henley thought his little brothers would be the next victims if he wasn't there. So that's like another reason that he felt trapped. Mm-hmm. The next victim. Oh, shoot, I missed one. Sorry. 5 days after Homer Garcia was killed, the driving school friend, John Sellers, was shot and buried at High Island Beach. It was 2 days before his 18th birthday. And interestingly, he was the only victim to be buried fully clothed. So I'm not really sure what happened or if, like, something kind of went wrong. But
were all the other
boys but their clothes would be next to them, like, in a bag or something. Because they would bury them, like, all their stuff next to them. Yeah,
what the fuck?
Okay, so that was on July 12th. So it's July 7th, July 12th. The next killing's July 19th. And then the next ones are July 25th. Like, it's like bang, 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 bang every few days. Yeah. He's insatiable. And this is when Brooks is like, bye. And Henley brings him the rest of these boys. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. Michael Balch was 15 when Henley picked him up and delivered him to Kroll. Just a week after John Sellers was murdered. Michael Balch was on his way to get a haircut, and that last name might sound familiar because Coral killed his older brother, Billy.
Yes, it does. Before. Yeah.
And, I mean, I can't imagine what this family went through and, like, losing both of their children to this monster. And also, the children were buried at different places. So Michael Balch was strangled and buried at Lake Sam Rayburn, and Billy Balch was buried at I think it was either High Island Beach or the boat shed.
Okay.
That was July 19th. July 25th, Marty Jones and Charles Carey Cobble. They were 18 and 17 respectively when they both disappeared. Marty Jones and Charles Cobble were housemates that lived across the street from Coral. They were last seen walking towards Coral's house with none other than Elmer Henley. Charles Cobble's wife was pregnant at the time of the murder. Cobble was shot twice in the head, and I think Jones was affixed. He was strangled. They were both found in Coral's boat shed.
So many in this fucking shed. Yeah, so
they found 17 bodies there, but there's more.
Oh my God.
That was July 25th. August 3rd. This is the last victim. The gang gets back together for the last murder. Honestly. I'm so happy that, I mean, I'm so glad I can make a voice for these people, but this has been so hard to learn about because it's so devastating. Like, there's just so many people that were victimized.
So Brooks is getting involved again for this?
Brooks is helping, but they don't know it's the last murder.
Right, but why is he getting involved again?
He just got pulled back in.
Oh, my God. Makes me so sad. I feel like he was so close to getting out of it.
So Brooks and Henley picked up a 13-year-old boy named James Dreamala. He was from South Houston and last seen riding his bike around his neighborhood. They lured James into the car by saying that they were collecting bottles to resell for a couple of bucks. His parents were Seventh-day Adventists, and he called them that night to say he was at a party across town. That would be the last time they ever heard from him.
Aww.
Brooks said that he bought the boy a pizza and sat and talked with him for 40 minutes before the torture took place. He was tied to Coral's torture board where he was raped, tortured, and strangled to death. Yeah, and he was 13. But that's where I feel like that's what Brooks is trying to comfort him and his, like, you know, it's like, it's fucked up, obviously. But
I just don't know. Like, I'm really angry at Brooks right now.
Tell the boy to run.
Also, why are you involved again? What got you involved again? Like, I don't know what roped him back in. I don't get that.
Well, they're still getting a bunch of money for each person they bring.
Oh, and now he has a family.
Yeah. Oh. I mean, Coral's still paying them. I think what was the equivalent? It was like $1,000 or something.
Oh, shit. Okay. I didn't. Where is Coral getting this money?
Yeah, right? I guess because he works at Houston Light Power and Lighting Company. At this point, and I guess he had money from the candy factory.
Okay, so he had, like, savings from that or something? Like, that's a lot of money to be spending.
I think electricians make pretty good money, honestly. For
both Henley and Brooks at this point, you know?
That, I'm going to end. Okay. Those are the rest of the victims of Coral. And mm-hmm. I'm going to end there. And then next episode, actually, I think I'm going to. Okay, so. I didn't want to go super in-depth about what happened to every child that was tortured by Coral, but
mm-hmm.
just to give some examples of, like, what these boys went through, they would have glass tubes stuck up their urethra in their penis and shattered while it was in their penis. They would be sodomized with anything that was around. He would assault them personally, and they would strangle them and let them breathe and strangle. There was just a lot of torture, and these were little, little boys. Mm-hmm. Oh, and also Coral would make them, like, give him oral sex and mm-hmm. things like that.
It's heartbreaking.
Oh, and they would be electrocuted sometimes.
Excuse me? Oh, my God.
Just their last minutes were not anything. I mean, this guy is really, really, like, one of the worst people I've ever read about.
How do we know about these details of torture? If Henley and Brooks...
The electrocution, we know because some of the boys would be buried with, like, the clips.
What the fuck? Okay.
And then I think the details we know from Henley and Brooks. And I think they might have...
But if they weren't there during, like, the worst parts?
But I think at the end, Henley was for sure.
Okay. Okay.
Because Henley was involved in, like, the...
Also, just because they're not there doesn't mean that Coral isn't, like, telling them about it after or something.
And Coral would tell them, and he would tell them, like, where other bodies were buried and stuff. And that's how they were saying. Okay.
Fuck.
He gets his retribution for sure. Like, it's actually really interesting what happens to Coral and how his, like, demise happens. And next episode, I'll talk about his ultimate demise. He does get killed. So he gets murdered in August of 1973. And then I'll talk about Henley and Brooks's trial, what happened to them. I'll talk about the Texas Equa search for more bodies and just like any other. Oh, and then about like kind of the effects on the families and stuff. Just any other missing pieces. I'll wrap up next episode. Sorry, I didn't mean to make this a part three or make it so depressing, but
I think it's important though to go through the details because the victims deserve the details to be told.
And people need to know that this happened because I do think the Houston police, they still need to step up and they still need to search.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And it needs to be put out there that this was fucked up and it's still fucked up. And you guys didn't finish what you started.
So true.
I think that's super important to like hold law enforcement accountable for this.
Absolutely. I'm excited to know. Well, gosh, it's kind of like a bittersweet feeling to know that he does end up getting killed, but then he never gets to like – be found guilty in court.
Look at the crime scene photo of his body. It's
oof. Okay. Okay.
It's like you'll I'm glad how he died.
Okay. That gives me hope.
I don't I mean I think it would have been really cathartic for a lot of families to know what happened to their sons.
Oh,
what
the fuck? I did not need to see that.
Of him, like, butt naked, face down. I'm like, I'm glad you fucking died like that, loser.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. Oh, gosh. Okay.
Obviously, if he was alive, who knows if he would have confessed or what? Or if it would have even stopped. That's the thing. I don't think it would have stopped.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's a good point. And, well, I'm just excited to know the rest of the story. But that was really good, Lily. Thank you for telling us the details and telling us the victims' names. It's so important.
Thank you. It's all, I'm glad. I'm glad to be done with this soon, though, but it's been interesting for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. We love you guys.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
We really appreciate all of our listeners and all of the support that we've been getting. We're building up our social media presence with Instagram. We're going to post on TikTok soon. And so thank you for supporting us on there. You can follow us on Instagram at MurderShowPod. And we also have an email address, which is MurderShowPod@gmail.com.
Yes, yes, that's us. Yeah, thank you so much. We're like so shocked when we look at how many people have watched it. Listen, we're like, what?
It's
so
like nice. 80. We're like, 80.
We're like, oh my God, there's another 5 listened last night.
It's amazing. We really appreciate it so much. And we just hope that you guys can connect with us, have these conversations with us, and we're open to any discussion about your opinions on any of the cases or any information that we like leave out that you find really interesting or important. So for us, this is such an open conversation to have.
Yeah, and if you have any suggestions, email us.
Definitely.
Or text us, because I'm sure like 99% of the people listening know us personally. So
that's a really good point. Okay. Awesome. Thank you guys.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.